and people rightfully resented the British and their colonial arrogance. Now, in the years after World War II, there was one politician who would soon put an end to this. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh was known for wanting to nationalize Iran's oil fields, and just like many Iranians, held a grudge against the 1933 agreement made by Reza Shah, which gave enormous concessions to the British to continue plundering the oil at Abadan. Mossadegh was appointed prime minister in 1951, and soon thereafter, Iran's parliament moved to nationalize all of Iran's oil fields, including Abadan, which at this point, keep in mind, Abadan was the largest oil refinery in the world. That should give you an idea of how badly the British wanted to keep their hands on it. They opted instead to stop Iran from controlling and using its own oil refineries through means of sabotage and other clandestine operations. An embargo or blockade was also imposed on Iran to stop it from being able to sell its own oil on the global market. The British felt that they had been robbed somehow, because they had discovered the oil, they had built the refineries, and they had developed Abadan. This is, of course, absurd. But the British would not accept this condition for long, and instead they resorted to the typical dirty tactics used by imperialists. They plotted a coup. The British called it Operation Boot. Meanwhile, the Americans, who were helping them, referred to it as Operation Ajax. The goal was to oust Mossadegh and reinstall the Shah and retake the oil. Now, while people often attribute the coup of 1953 to the CIA, and that's partly correct, the role of the British cannot be overlooked. We know, for example, that Mossadegh's chief of police, Mahmoud Afshar Tus, was kidnapped, tortured, and executed by Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6. Once this coup was completed and Mossadegh was deposed, the Americans and British moved quickly to help the Shah establish and train the SAVAK, Iran's secret police. The SAVAK were trained by the CIA, who had lots of experience training people in torture all over the world, in Jakarta, in Latin America, as part of their Cold War campaign against communists. Now, the CIA, in training the SAVAK, taught them how to repress dissidents, activists, and anyone who opposed the Shah. This is collectively remembered in Iran as a period of immense struggle and great suffering. The CIA did finally release documents titled The Battle for Iran, showing its involvement in the coup of 1953. The United Kingdom, however, to this day, maintains secrecy regarding the matter and has still not owned up or confessed to its damning role in the overthrow of Mossadegh. Joining me is Navid Zarinal, doctoral candidate and researcher at Columbia University. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show, Navid. It's a pleasure to have you.
Sure. Happy to be on the show, Richard.
So oil was one of the most lucrative things for the British Empire in Iran, and Mossadegh's nationalization represented a threat for them. What are some of the other things that aren't very much talked about, the other economic and political reasons for which the UK backed the Shah along with the US?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as you correctly say, the support of the UK for the Shah was based on oil, and Mossadegh wanted to nationalize the oil. So the British, and to a lesser extent the Americans, were upset about that, and they backed the Shah in opposition to Mossadegh. So that was one reason. But as the years went by, actually Iran got more concessions regarding sovereignty on oil. So a big reason, another reason that the UK and the US and also the West more generally backed the Shah was because the Shah was a big ally against anti-imperialist movements in the region and perhaps in the world at large. And also he was not a big annoyance when it came to the question of Zionism and Palestinian independence. And there's actually, I think, a good analogy to be made here to the SARS. So before the Russian Revolution, a lot of the anti-imperialist and progressive movements in the world were opposed to the SARS, the Russians. And in a similar way, in this period, so from 1950s onward to the present day, I would say a lot of the anti-imperialist movements are opposed to the US and the UK and the West more generally. And the Shah, since he was friendly to the US and the UK, he could be used as an instrument against these anti-imperialist movements.
Right. And a lot of people in Iran, they remember this period for its brutal repression. One of the most notable events, perhaps, is referred to as Black Friday. Can you maybe elaborate on that for us, as well as the secret police, the SAVAK, and just in general how political dissidents were treated and what the climate was like under the Shah?
That's right. So there were numerous demonstrations preceding the revolution, and there was one very famous protest known as Black Friday in English nomenclature, and it happened in what was called the Jaale Square at the time, and they changed the name after the revolution to the Martyr Square or Maidan Shohada. In this demonstration, the Shah's forces killed a number of people in this Black Friday demonstration, so it became a big event after the revolution that's remembered every year. Black Friday was an example of the wide variety of demonstrations that were happening, and also it indicated the high participation in the Iranian revolution, because if you look at the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, or coming even more forward, the Romanian Revolution of 1989, the participation usually was about a couple percent. It wasn't very high, but in the Iranian Revolution, the estimates are that 10% of the population marched and actively participated in making their revolution. And regarding the second part of your question regarding the SAVAK or the secret police, so just as Shah security forces were on the streets containing the protests, the SAVAK would also gather intelligence. And they were also close to imperialist U.S., and they had a close eye on the activists and the dissidents. But what's interesting is that the Shahs generally gave more space to the Islamic dissent to operate, and they were harsher on the socialist, Marxist, and leftist dissent. An example, I think this is a very powerful example of Shah's surveillance state and how his state would treat dissidents and revolutionary opposition. There was a program connected to the state that was called Goftegu, which means conversation, and very similar to what you and I are having, Richard. There was a conversation between an anchor and a dissident who was in prison, and they would bring the prisoner on the show, and they were forced recantation. So the dissident had to recant on live TV, and there was one particular short story writer and cultural critic named Ghulam Hussein Saidi, who was tortured in prison, and then he was forced to come on this program called Goftegu, and there he had to recant the things like the criticism of the Shah's government that he had made. And there's a very memorable line by a poet named Ahmad Shamlu about what happened to Saidi, because he also committed suicide eventually. And what Shamlu said is that what said, I'll read it to you, quoting Shamlu, what said farewell to Shah's prison was merely a half-living corpse. That man with his wondrous creativity, after the bodily and mostly mental tortures of Evin prison, became utterly lifeless.
Many in the West, especially the United States, when they think of the Iranian Revolution, they always see it through the lens of the hostage crisis, right? For example, this film with Ben Affleck, Argo, which they even won an Oscar for, you know, the whole Hollywood propaganda. Can you tell us why that's a faux lens to see the revolution through, and why this misses the bigger picture here?
That's right. It is a very U.S.-centric view to look at one of the biggest and most important revolutions of the 20th century. And as we discussed earlier, the real reason for a revolution was the imperialist support for the Shah that brought the crisis of legitimacy for the Shah. And then I think a reason might have been anxieties by the revolutionaries that, just as in 1953, the U.S. orchestrated a coup d'etat against Mossadegh, again, the U.S. could intervene in Iranian affairs. It's just a very minor event in the revolution, but from the American point of view, it became the event of the Iranian revolution. And as you said, it was represented in really terrible films like Argo. And if you actually look at the DVD cover, the Blu-ray cover for Argo, you see Ben Affleck looking very contemplative and rational, looking in the distance, but then the Iranian revolutionaries almost look like zombies. They're holding things, and, you know, they're kind of, there's just a collective of them looking very scary and menacing, about to come and harm people. So it's interesting that even though Ben Affleck seems to be a nice anti-Orientalist, I mean, we saw in Bill Maher, he actually defended Muslims against Bill Maher's Islamophobia. But these kind of representations, when it comes to political difference, are still very much part of the American consciousness.
In the aftermath of the revolution, how did the West react, especially the US and the UK, both in the short term and in the long term, to try and undermine Iran after they suddenly lost control of their puppet monarch?
Yes, so I think the attempts to sabotage the revolution started from early on. I mean, I think we can look to the example of the Iraq-Iran war as a very unfortunate war that was devastating for both countries. And I think the West was using Saddam Hussein as a way to weaken and sabotage the revolution. But I think even the bigger attempts to sabotage the revolution came through such things as a currency sabotage. So since Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal, basically Iranian currency has collapsed, and that makes it very difficult to actually bring foreign imports in. And also the effect of sanctions. The problem is that when Iran has a difficult time transacting in the international banking system, it's very difficult to get medicines in. But what's, I think, really important to keep in mind that despite the American attempt to sabotage the Iranian revolution, Iran has a very strong national production industry, and that has allowed it to withstand the American so-called maximum pressure.
Speaking more broadly, what are the main anti-imperialist values and lessons that the revolution brought with it, and how have they permeated in Iranian society and remained throughout the last four decades?
I would say a big value of the Iranian revolution is that it's providing an alternative to the globalization that is led by the U.S. and multinational corporations that I'm speaking of, is that there's a uniformity in our taste, in leisure, in our economic choices, in our political models. So everything is becoming uniform. But the thing about Iran is that when people travel here, they actually see the political and economic difference here. So I think the political model is very different. So theocratic democracy is what I would describe it as. And the thing is, because our cognition, our political cognition is so Eurocentric, we see that as an oxymoron. But the thing is, I think they can be reconciled. Just as you can reconcile equality and liberty under liberalism, I think it's very doable to reconcile theocracy with democracy. And I think that's also an interesting Iranian experiment, an alternative to the European models that have been universalized since colonialism. So even though you do have things like class inequality, and one of the biggest aspirations of the Iranian revolution was class equality, but unfortunately that has been much more difficult to achieve. But despite this, there is still an alternative to the globalized neoliberal model that the U.S. and multinational corporations are pursuing. And you see that, I think, when you travel here. And I think a second important value and legacy of the Iranian revolution has been the support for the Palestinian cause. And I actually see this as an ideological and also moral commitment to Palestine and the Palestinian people. And that was an early aspiration of revolution that has persisted to the present day.
When we talk about the axis of resistance, you know, we talk about Iran, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and Iran has supported all these various resistance movements, and actually not just in the Middle East, but even with Venezuela, this partnership and alliance. Can we argue that this is very much indeed one of the main values spurred on by the revolution? And how is it that Iran has become this backbone of these anti-imperialist efforts?
The support for resistance to imperialism is definitely a value of the Iranian revolution that we see both in ideology and in a state practice. And again, I think, I mean, it definitely has a geopolitical element to it, but I think a big part of it is ideological, philosophical, and ethical. And I think, as you correctly mentioned too, it's not, because, you know, in the Western media, the representation is that whoever is Shia, Iran just supports them, so they turn it into a sectarian issue. But as you mentioned, I mean, Venezuela, I don't think they have too many Shias, but Iran is a big supporter of Venezuela. So I think it's an ideological and ethical commitment against imperialism. And because of this, they are supporting a resistance movement against imperialism. And it's not easy to do. It comes at a big cost to the country, for example, the sanctions, but it is something that the Iranian revolution is committed to.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
After the coup in Iran in 1953, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company changed its name to something that many of you are familiar with, British Petroleum, or BP. And when the U.S. carried out another coup the following year in Guatemala to depose of the democratically elected President Arbenz, another multinational was also at the heart of this dispute, United Fruit Company. And they also rebranded and changed their name afterwards to Chiquita Brands International. Now, while these corporations change their names and try to rebrand, the tactic remains very much the same, and we continue to see a lot of the same covert means and clandestine operations being used by the United States and the United Kingdom to overthrow other governments just for the sake of stealing their resources. As they say, war is a racket. Now, when the Islamic Revolution came about decades later, this changed everything and shocked the world. All of a sudden, the Shah, a puppet monarch loyal to the West, was overthrown and replaced by an Islamic Republic that was opposed to the West and to Israel. But it's important to note that this didn't happen overnight. Protests and movements to oppose the Shah started already in late 1977 and grew steadily with a coalition of students, leftists, Islamists. This broad coalition is a very important factor to which the success of the revolution can be attributed to and shows the plurality of the uprising by the Iranian people against the Western-backed monarchy. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians, millions in fact, took to the streets in mass protests, prompting the Shah to declare martial law and impose a curfew. This repression became especially violent during this period, with one of the most horrific moments being the fire at Cinema Rex, which was, quite frankly, a terrorist attack, with over 400 people burned to death inside of a movie theater by four men working under orders of the SAVAK, the secret police. Another instance referred to in English as Black Friday was at Jaleh Square, now named Martyr Square, where the Shah's troops gunned down hundreds of protesters. It would only be a matter of months in January of 1979 until the Shah would leave Iran like a coward, pretending that he was going on vacation. He actually never returned. He stayed there in exile until his death. Shortly thereafter, Imam Khomeini finally returned to Iran on February 1st of 1979. Greeted by jubilant crowds after spending 15 years in exile. In fact, over a million Iranians flocked to the streets in a show of support. Widely regarded as both the spiritual and the de facto leader of the revolution, an Islamic Republic was established through a national referendum and the adoption of a constitution under Imam Khomeini as Iran's first leader. And this marked the beginning of a whole new era for the nation. Finally, after decades of rule under a Western-backed puppet sponsored by the U.S. and the U.K., Iranians had now finally reclaimed their country by taking to the streets in the millions, voting in a new constitution and establishing a new Islamic Republic. And of course, with that said, Iranians, of course, regained sovereignty not just over their nation, but also over their natural resources, including the oil, which the British had plundered for so long. So, again, when we talk about the Islamic Revolution of 1979, it's really important to also talk about the history behind it, about the role that the United States and the United Kingdom played in the coups in 1953 by installing the Shah, who betrayed his country's riches to these multinational corporations and brutally repressed the Iranian people. This is a very, very important part of history that many Americans and many British do not understand, let alone know of. They have hardly any clue of the atrocities, the countless coups, interventions, the meddling, and all the nefarious covert operations that their governments carry out all across the world in their names. From their point of view, Iranian history starts in 1979, and that's all they know, and it's completely awash with anti-Oriental propaganda, which seeks to demonize Iran. The truth is that Iran's revolution represented a landmark moment, the awakening of a movement, and the will of the people to fight and regain their sovereignty from the West. This caused a huge upset for Western governments and the multinationals that run them behind the scenes. In reality, Britain and the United States don't want other countries to be democracies. They want other countries that they can control, both politically and economically. Only then are those countries considered allies. You know, when nations like Iran, who are not only resource-rich, but rich in culture and history, actually stand up for themselves, it is extremely embarrassing for the suits in Whitehall and Capitol Hill who think that they are above everyone else. Iran's Islamic Revolution wasn't just an upheaval of Iran's political climate, it was also an act of defiance and an act of anti-imperialism. This idea of standing up to oppressors is something that is very deeply ingrained in Iran's culture, and this is not just something we see internally, but also internationally. Iran has been an ally and helped to liberate my country of Syria from the various jihadist groups and the scourge of foreign terrorists that once again Britain and the United States have financed along with Saudi Arabia and others. And equally, since the revolution, Iran has helped Lebanon and Palestine in their resistance against the Zionist occupation and in the protection of their lands. And more recently, we see in Iraq and Venezuela how Iran has helped these nations stand up against foreign invaders and imperialism. This is very important for people to understand, and it also explains why the West has held a grudge against Iran ever since it broke free from Occidental rule, seeking to cripple it always with sanctions, with war, with intimidation. Now, not just because Iranians took back control of their country, but also because they outmaneuver and help other resistant movements regionally and globally, and help other people stand up for themselves. Sure, there's no such thing as a perfect country or a perfect political system in the world, but there is something to be said about a nation and a people that are brave enough to stand up to tyranny, to colonization, to white supremacy, and then help their brothers and sisters elsewhere to do the same. It is a remarkable feat of resistance and anti-imperialism, and why Iran continues to be a thorn in the side of those oppressors who seek to colonize the Middle East. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yes. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The revolution came and created a free atmosphere for criticism and reform. This has been the case throughout the past 32 years, even during the early years after the victory of the revolution. Before the revolution, the country totally depended on the West in science and technology. I have said this on many occasions before. Some parts of our military planes had been used up and had to be fixed, but they did not allow the engineers of the Air Force to take it apart and see what it was, let alone think of fixing it. They used to send that part to America by plane and bring another one instead. Or if one of the parts was supposed to be fixed, they used to fix it in America. There was no industry. Our industry was limited to simple assemblage without any innovations. After the revolution, scientific and national self-confidence was created in the country. We witnessed the emergence of so many scientists, prominent and great scientists in different fields. Today, there are very good scientists inside the country who have few equals in the world. Our scientists moved forward and they were mostly young. Iran had no influence over global or even regional issues before the revolution. It had been humiliated. It did not have the slightest effect on different issues. After the revolution, the glory and greatness of this nation in the eyes of other nations across the world and its influence on regional issues have astonished the enemies. The enemies have been forced to admit this. Today, on foreign news websites, they are constantly speaking about Iran's influence and domination and its presence in regional issues. They admit this, though with hostile motives. Before the revolution, we simply imitated the West in cultural areas. But after the revolution, cultural invasion was recognized as a danger. There are many such topics. These are essential points.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Khalid reporters.
The U.S. detains oil ships is the slogan chanted by protesters in a rally held in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The protesters condemned the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition and demanded their release.
We hope that the new U.S. administration would lift the blockade on Yemen, but unfortunately it seems it is following the same policy. Not a single liter of oil derivatives has been released over the past weeks. The suffocating siege has deprived millions of Yemenis of fuel and deteriorated their life conditions.
The fuel crisis has deeply impacted the health sector of Yemen, as major hospitals like Al-Thawra and Sana'a are on the verge of closure due to lack of fuel to provide health services.
Our health sector is negatively impacted by the siege. Some hospitals have stopped offering services due to lack of fuel. Intensive care rooms do not work any longer. The siege is targeting the lives of our nation. We call on the world to step in and put an end to this crisis.
12 Yemeni oil vessels are still detained by the Saudi-led coalition, contributing to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen that is on the brink of famine due to the Saudi-led war underway since 2015.
Yemenis blame the United Nations for its inaction against the Saudi Arabia's illegal detention of oil ships. They say the UN inaction contributes to Yemen's deprivation of oil derivatives stored on the ships. Abu Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Studies now reveal that child poverty jumped nearly 10% in 2020, meaning one in six children lives in poverty in the richest country in the world. The same study found that if Washington gave direct payments to parents totaling $85 billion, or just 0.4% of its GDP, the child poverty rate would plummet 75% and affect only one in 20 children.
The American capitalist ideology has a strong hold on everybody in every class. There is only a set of notions that, you know, kids are poor because their parents are stupid or their parents are lazy and therefore they don't deserve it. Or if we spend the money to do something for kids, we're all going to go bankrupt. The whole country's going to go bankrupt. This nonsense is out there.
Congress is touting a plan to increase the child tax credit from $2,000 to $3,000 annually. Many note that's a refund for those with jobs and not an immediate direct payment to buy children diapers, food, school supplies, and other necessities. The extra $1,000 tax refund would cover only about 6 weeks of child care, as their costs have risen 60% since the start of the pandemic.
All of these things are happening to big swaths of the American people that are never represented on, you know, mainstream media to the world, never projected out to the world. And we can solve them. There's nothing that prevents us from solving them besides political will.
The discussions on child poverty come as Congress has postponed yet again a long-awaited round of major household stimulus, this time in order to focus on the second impeachment trial of ex-President Donald Trump. Last year, American-style lockdowns led to the largest annual increase in the overall poverty rate in more than 50 years. Many say the problem is not poor children or even poor parents, but the long-standing political indifference towards both groups. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive, because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the the previous 2.5 years, and we are still the PTI government has not increased even 1% or salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed, and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
These kind of actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupont-Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates, and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history, and our identity. Today, we see that France is again complicit with Israel. But nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or both protests against the inauguration of a Ben Gurion square. They ask the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
tear gas and the Lati charge. That is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive, because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300%. Inflation rate has been high and increased during the the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% or salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed, and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The seventh so-called Ukraine Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, and not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations, we don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the nation's media and political elite are consumed by the impeachment trial of ex-president Donald Trump, talks on a desperately needed and long-delayed major economic stimulus package have been forced on hold. After an economically devastating pandemic year, Main Street has been clamoring for economic aid. President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill has a huge 75% public approval rating. But as Democrats issue more of the exact details, fissures are mounting between their left and right factions. Republicans who want to reduce the stimulus package are being accused of defying public opinion. Discontent is also rising as Biden's proposal backtracks, pulls his support, or reduces a host of economic promises, ending Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and all while many say Main Street needed all of that and more in the world's richest country.
If we're not talking about $2,000 per month with retro pay and also a forgiveness of all mortgages as well as rents, and I don't mean like moratorium where they have to pay it down the line. If you couldn't pay $1,000 a month, then you're not going to be able to pay $5,000 over the course of 5 months to do it. That's just asinine.
There is mounting backlash over Biden's plan to abandon the proposed raising of the minimum wage from $7 to $15 an hour. Such an increase wouldn't just reverse decades of soaring wage inequality, it would spur much-needed economic growth amid the pandemic recession. The federal minimum wage has not been lifted in over a decade, further impoverishing the nation's working poor and lower classes. The gap between campaign promises and what looks like will actually be delivered may explain why a top poll recently showed that 70% of the nation is dissatisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the nation today.
Capitalism needs this to be put on pause. Actually, I mean, you know, my opinion, capitalism needs to be replaced, but capitalism needs to be on pause from the banks on down. And the reality is, if these measures are not done, these drastic measures are not done, then no, America won't heal.
Mid-March is the earliest date the third stimulus is likely to be passed. Reduced unemployment benefits from the modest and also last-minute second stimulus package will expire by April. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the U.K. weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a U.K. court decision banning the sale of U.K.-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters, and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Fariza, London.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf visited Moscow for talks with a number of Russian officials on regional and international issues aimed at further cementing the two sides' strategic relations. In a meeting with the chairwoman of Federation Council of Russia, Valentina Matviyenko, Ghalibaf said his visit to Russia has become special since he carries a message from Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This important message is about the region and the world powers and has the meaning that the bilateral relation between Iran and Russia will be strategic and deep for several decades. Iran's leader has also thanked the Russian Federation and China for the fair position on the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the US did not fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
The Iranian official also made it clear that Iran has received nothing from the JCPOA other than sanctions and underlined that Iran will do its best to neutralize unilateral sanctions imposed on the country.
Our goal is to neutralize sanctions, that is, to strengthen our economy through expanding ties with friendly countries that have independence in decision-making.
For her part, chairwoman of the Federation Council of Russia said the visit of Ghalibaf would give fresh impetus to the relations between the two states. She also said that Moscow is eager to expand ties with Iran despite obstacles on this way.
Industry, clean energy, counterterrorism, defense, technology, culture are areas of strategy, and this is where Russia and Iran say they can establish cooperation to counter the U.S. unilateralism as well as their culture of dominance.
This visit is intended to help Russia and Iran find a ground for further cooperation. This will help us to stop the global wave of chaos and lawlessness. This will also pave the way for putting an end to the immoral sanctions on Iran and the Russian Federation.
Iranian Parliament Speaker arrived in Moscow on Sunday at the official invitation of Russia's State Duma at the head of a high-ranking parliamentary delegation. During his visit, he held talks with some senior Russian officials, including Secretary of Security Council of Russia Nikolai Patrushev, on a number of regional and international issues, from terrorism to upcoming international meeting on Syria in the Astana format in Sochi. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump has been acquitted by the U.S. Senate in his second impeachment trial for his role in the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol, a verdict that underscores the sway America's 45th president still holds over the Republican Party, even after leaving office. It was always unlikely that 17 Republican senators would jump ship and join Democrats to impeach former President Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer columnists Sam Levine and Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Acquitted in Second Impeachment Trial. Stay with us for more of Sam Levine and Lauren Gambino's article.
We'll be right back.
Donald Trump has been acquitted by the U.S. Senate in his second impeachment trial for his role in the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol, a verdict that underscores the sway America's 45th president still holds over the Republican Party even after leaving office. It was always unlikely that 17 Republican senators would jump ship and join Democrats to impeach former President Donald Trump. After just 5 days of debate in the chamber that was the scene of last month's invasion, a divided Senate fell 10 votes short of the two-thirds majority required to convict high crimes and misdemeanors. A conviction would have allowed the Senate to vote to disqualify Donald J. Trump from holding future office. 7 Republicans joined every Democrat to declare Trump guilty on the charge of incitement of insurrection after his months-long quest to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden and its deadly conclusion on 6th of January when Congress met to formalize the election results. The 57-43 vote was most partisan support for conviction ever in a presidential impeachment trial. The outcome, which was never in doubt, reflected both the still raw anger of senators over Donald Trump's conduct and his supporters as his supporters stormed the Capitol last month, and the vice-like grip the defeated president still holds over the Republican Party. Among the Republicans willing to defy Trump were Richard Burr of North Carolina, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. The swift conclusion of the Senate trial, only the 4th presidential impeachment in American history, and Donald Trump's 2nd in just over a year, capped one of the most tumultuous chapters in the nation's political history. Still shaken by the deadly riot that threatened America's commitment to a peaceful transfer of power, senators of both parties were eager to turn the page. Trump's acquittal came after grave warnings from the 9 Democratic House managers serving as prosecutors that Donald Trump continued to pose a threat to the nation and to democracy itself. If this is not a high crime and misdemeanor against the United States of America, then nothing is, Congressman Jamie Raskin, the lead manager, pleaded with senators in the final moments before they rendered their judgments as jurors and witnesses. President Trump must be convicted for the safety and democracy of our people. From the outset, Donald Trump's allies in the Senate made clear they had no intention of convicting him. Though many Republicans explicitly supported or implicitly indulged Trump's baseless claim of a stolen election, few defended his actions during the trial itself. Instead, they relied on a technical argument advanced by his attorneys and rejected by a majority of the Senate, as well as leading constitutional scholars, that the proceedings were unconstitutional because Donald Trump was no longer in office. In a floor speech after the vote, Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, said Donald Trump's conduct preceding the assault on the Capitol amounted to a disgraceful dereliction of duty by the former president, who he held practically and morally responsible for promoting the events of Wednesday, 6th of January. But Mitch McConnell concluded that the Senate was never meant to serve as a moral tribunal and suggested instead that Donald Trump could still face criminal prosecution. President Trump is still liable for everything he did whilst he was in office, Mitch McConnell said. He didn't get away with anything yet. At a news conference after the vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi